Testing, testing.
Delighted, Dave, that you remind me that it was 72 when I moved from Chevrolet, Pontiac, and commercial vehicles to Olds, Buick, and Cadillac, BOC as we call it in-house, because as I've told you, I have a very poor memory.
Well,
I think
good.
Of the future, not of the past.
You're doing pretty good.
But I came into the upper level of the market just about the time the oil embargo hit. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was a lot of conversation within the corporation about whether our products were right and were we going to deliver the kind of fuel efficiency the customer was going to look for, because everyone expected the price of gasoline to rise dramatically. So many programs were looked at, and the first one I can recall coming into this building as a result of that oil embargo was the need to create a small Cadillac. Mm-hmm. Ed Cole was very strongly behind that. He was pushing hard. And for some years prior to 73, we had done some fiberglass models of a small Cadillac. Uh-huh. We were experimenting here in the building. Because mm-hmm. on and off over the years, people in this building had believed that Cadillac ought to have a smaller, very sophisticated package. And I don't mean a car that would compete with Chevrolet by any means. Mm-hmm. And then, as I've said, the embargo came along and the word came down that we'd better get started on a small Cadillac. It was a bona fide corporate program. And we looked at everything we had done and determined the direction for ourselves. But it wasn't more than a week later, as I recall this incident, that we were told we had something like 6 weeks to create the car. We normally take 9 to 14 months, mm-hmm. depending on how many divisions are involved. Mm-hmm. And in 6 weeks, you can do nothing but make mistakes. Mm. So people like myself, and Jack Humbert was my assistant at the time, were damn concerned about how we were going to do this in 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. The Cadillac studio was busily occupied with other programs, so we went down into what we call our Advanced Design 1 studio, which was also reporting to me at the time, mm-hmm. and elected to do the car there. A fellow named Stan Parker was chief designer of the studio at the time. And we got busy in a hurry with 6 weeks. It didn't look like we were going to have the opportunity to ever take the car out of the platform and get it out in its natural setting, daylight, you know. As a matter of fact, we never did. The car never moved out of that studio. We designed it, we refined it, we tuned it. We'd had meetings with Cadillac, and I can't recall now who the general manager was. We'd have to look in the books to find out who was running Cadillac at the time. But the release date came, and we cut the car loose. And I can remember sitting in the office I occupied down the hall here with Humbert, and talking about this, and we were very, very concerned that we were releasing a car we had never seen outdoors.
Humbert was?
Jack Humbert was my assistant. He used to run the Pontiac room in the 60s. He created some very good-looking Pontiacs. Jack was an excellent designer, and he could refine an automobile like nobody in this building. But we thought, what the hell, they didn't give us the time. We did the best we could, and that's it. We've got to live with it. Well, the car was finally released. Every surface and every detail was released to our drafting room. And the day came when we could now clean it up, dynock it, and take it outdoors and see what in hell we've got. Well, we got it out there, and we were all pleasantly surprised. It is a darn good-looking car, in our view. There were a few lines we might have adjusted. As a matter of fact, there were a few lines I tried to adjust. Took the car back in the building and made some corrections in the rear end, but Cadillac couldn't accept it based on their engineering tooling time frame. It wasn't in that block of time. So we had to live with what we had. Fortunately, the car got into the marketplace and did beautifully. As a matter of fact, you go out to California today, you'll see that original Seville everywhere in mint condition. And it seems that the Californians like that car better than what we have currently. So that was an interesting experience. I'd never gone through a program where we had to do it that fast without checking our papers outdoors. And once we had launched that, then of course the corporations set a goal for themselves to downsize all their vehicles. The next series of cars that we were to downsize were the standard size family sedans and coupes and the luxury sedans, what we call B and C in the corporation. Well, that program went on for a long time. It might have gone on for as long as 14 to 18 months. And of course, there were five car divisions involved, from Chevrolet through Cadillac. And the concern on the part of the corporation and design staff as to how small we make it was great. Mm-hmm. People like Pete Estes, who was our president at the time, would come by once a week, and do you think we're too small? Should we go a little larger? And we were not quite sure either, because when you took the clay out and looked at it with the current car, the new, what was new in 71, I believe, there was a lot of shrink in the package. They were a lot lighter, and the fuel efficiency targets we had set for ourselves looked good based on what we were doing. And after much trepidation, the decision was made to go. And right up until the car got into the dealer's showrooms, everyone was concerned. And I guess they, if memory serves me correctly, they got started a little slowly that first year. Mm-hmm. The customer wasn't totally accepting the package size. And as a result, our competitors gained some market points that first year. But as we got into the second year, the car got stronger. And the third year, we were right back where we should have been with our volumes. Mm-hmm. So I guess it does take the consumer some time to adjust. Yeah. It's a cultural shock. Americans have been driving large vehicles for so darn long that they found it difficult to accept this package size.
Hard to equate smallness with...
Pardon me?
It's hard for them to equate smallness with quality and
price.
And price.
Mm-hmm. If somebody is spending, by today's standards, $15,000-$18,000 for a luxury sedan, there are people out there that still believe it ought to be 230 inches long, that you can't buy quality in a small package. But that's not necessarily true. You can spend $1 million on a tiny little diamond. Mm-hmm. Then we went on from there to downsize our personalized coupes, such as the Eldorado, Toronado, Riviera, and the Seville, and the process continued right up until today.
Have any second thoughts as you got into it? Gee, we shouldn't have done this, or look forward, made the right decision?
Never.
I have never heard
that from any member of the corporate team, from any general managers. Once we launched the program, everyone got behind it and worked like hell to get the product sold and believed in them.
Right.
We saw no other course to pursue. As a matter of fact, when the car was out on the road for about 2 years, we started planning the next generation, that it apparently had to come a little smaller because these CAFE targets became tougher. And as you know, I guess the current target for next year is 27.5 miles a gallon for fuel economy average for a corporation. And the industry, Ford and General Motors especially, are in Washington trying to bring that down to 26, or we're not going to build a larger automobiles. And if we don't build a larger automobiles, a lot of people will be unemployed out there. And in our view, the customer doesn't have choices, and he should.
I think the Transportation Department is moving in your direction.
I'm not abreast of what's happened in the last few weeks because I've been away on vacation. So
my impression that Dole will be sympathetic, Elizabeth Dole will be sympathetic to both yours and Ford's requests.
We certainly hope so, because we'd love to supply a full line of vehicles. We are a full line builder here at General Motors.
Right.
And I suspect Chrysler's position is proper for them. Mm-hmm. Because they're not a full-line builder, and they've got a lot of small, fuel-efficient cars and want the standard to remain where it is.
One or two platforms.
Yeah.
Incidentally, is it my recollection that although Ford rejoiced in the fact that their competitive position was enhanced by your decision, at least the first year, but in truth, they really didn't have the money to downsize, did they?
No, they had made a decision not to do it. I wouldn't know why.
I think it was financial.
It may have been financial, but you got to bite the bullet at a time like that, because you know the game is moving in one direction. Congress had passed the CAFE standards, and there was no other way to go.
Well, GM borrowed, as Ford should have done.
Yes.
And said, we're going that way. We need
you
the money. You've
got to go that way. If you want to remain in business, you're going to have to do it. And the programs were planned over a period of time, so we weren't doing three or four in one year. First the B cars, and then the personalized coupes, and then we went into the A, well, I guess the X. The Citation was the first thing we brought out, actually.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a beauty.
Well, we downsized the large cars, and then we came in with a small transverse front-wheel drive Citation, which did a lot for us from a fuel economy point of view. We had a few recalls that didn't help, but the car was rushed to market because there was a need for it out there. And, of course, downsizing, Dave, continues even today. We're doing vehicles for the late 80s that will be lighter and far more fuel efficient, with the eye on one target, and that is to maintain interior comfort. Mm-hmm. We're trying as hard as we know how not to shrink those internal dimensions.
Right.
The American consumer is not going to buy a tighter car.
No.
He wants all the space he can get inside. He wants leg room, he wants head room and torso room. And we're trying to maintain that, even though we reduce the exterior dimensions of the vehicle.
How are you solving that?
How are we solving that?
Yeah.
By working with a 9H pencil as we look at the occupants on the vehicle and finding every little millimeter, and doing thinner doors and thinning up the outside of the shapes, getting weight out, reducing length, which takes weight out.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've probably dropped 1,500 to 1,800 pounds since we've started this downsizing process with most of our products. Now that, along with a lot of attention to aerodynamics, is giving the customer far more fuel-efficient vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
I know myself, I'm currently driving a Buick Park Avenue, and when I go back to about 1971 or two, that large luxury sedan, and I drove those, it would take me two tankfuls a week to get from the office to home. This current Park Avenue, I can drive all week long from office to home and back again, and I've still got fuel in the tank on Friday.
Incredible.
So we've made some great gains.
You were the leader, certainly, and I think most of the industry looked to you for that.
If you take the lower end of our lines and measure them with the low end of everyone else's lines, such as Chrysler or Ford or the Japanese, you'll find our cars are just as efficient, fuel efficient, as theirs are. But we have so many top line automobiles that bring our average down. But the customer is demanding that automobile. There are people out there buying a rear wheel drive Chevrolet with V8 engines in them.
Sure.
They've got to have that V8.
I know. Well, you've conditioned them to ask for it.
Well, I don't know that we conditioned them. I think they were demanding more
really?
Power back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, of course. The hot rod generation in the 50s and 60s.
They've never really gotten over that.
We're getting back into more performance because the customer is demanding it.
Yeah.
We brought out a J automobile with a focus entirely on fuel efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And because the car didn't have the performance the customer expected, they turned away from us in that first year or two until we fixed the performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now the car is selling extremely well.
Yeah.
The American consumer demands performance along with fuel efficiency, and that isn't an easy assignment.
It must drive you crazy trying to figure out exactly what mix is the most will be the most saleable in terms of.
Well, you try to offer the customer a wide variety of engines, transmissions, so that they can select and put together the package they personally are interested in.
So you're very flexible in that area.
Yes.
Yeah.
In paint, in trims, in options, in engines, transmissions, and that you must do today if you want to remain competitive.
Right. Well, moving you back, as I sometimes do, back to mid-70s now. You're pretty much the chief assistant to Mitchell at this time.
Yes,
Mitchell's thinking
I'm
about
reporting it. Directly to Mill.
And you're handling the upper end of the line, and Mitchell's probably thinking about retirement about this time. What was the situation in the design center at that time, in terms of?
You mean in terms of human relationships within the organization?
Yeah,
Well, I can't. You'd have to speak to Bill about what his thoughts were in that time frame, because he was three or four years away from retirement. He never revealed his inner thoughts to me.
Oh, he never said
anything? No. Uh-huh. And he tried to stay active out in the studios. And, of course, when we did something out in the rooms, we never released anything without inviting Bill in. You know, if I changed the entire side of the car and the studio and Jack Humbert and myself were happy with what we had and we did it in a week, mm-hmm. I'd invite him in and say, this is what we like, Bill, this is the way we'd like to run. And he'd either say yes or I don't think you have it, you better keep working. So that's the way we were operating right. in that time frame.
Yeah.
When Bill first took over after Earl left, he was extremely active in the rooms and pretty much dictating design.
Mm-hmm.
And as he became more comfortable with his position and the people and their talents, he backed off and let them run it. Which is, in my view, the proper way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Is that your technique today?
I have been operating that way from day one.
Good.
I don't go out there and hold anybody's hand, nor do I go out there and dictate design.
Mm-hmm.
I will go out there, as I did yesterday, and stop something because I don't think they have it. But I won't tell them how to do it.
Good.
We may in discussion, discussions in the room with the team, paint a word picture of where we may go. But I don't want to take my work in there because you don't build people that way. They've got to face the problem. They've got to shoulder the responsibility.
Right.
Irv spent a lot of years in those studios and created a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Now I find myself in a different position, and I firmly believe that the way we're running this place is correct.
Good.
And I wouldn't change it.
Good. Well, Mitchell, by this time, has probably had reached the senior executive level like you have today, and sitting back and letting the teams do the
pretty much
the work.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably began to think about retirement a year or two before he retired.
I imagine he was thinking about it, and he had developed, probably in the last 5 or 8 years, a love of motorcycles.
Oh, had he?
Oh, yes. And he was buying motorcycles, and he had a little shop down the street here,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't like the shape of current motorcycles, so he had a designer and they'd redesign the bike and create their own forms, and he'd paint them in very glamorous colors and then have leathers tailored in the same color to fit the motorcycle. But I don't mean to suggest that Bill forgot automobiles, but he developed this love of bikes, and he stayed with that even after his retirement.
Did
he? Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, he, when he created his own design organization, he had a contract with either Yamaha or Suzuki or someone in Japan where he was designing their motorcycles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Isn't that interesting? It's a wonder he didn't suggest that GM take over Yamaha so he keep it in the corporation.
He may have, for all I know.
Well, you're downsizing. Their program is on course for the next, this is mid-70s, your downsizing program is, everybody's enthusiastic about it, and it's on schedule for the next 10 years, and what motivated the pace of the downsizing, without criticizing anything? It seems to me that the downsizing has been an evolutionary approach to it, I think, over the years, at GM. Ford went up to a point and then suddenly plop, you know, zapped.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys, and I suspect this may be your philosophy, apparently have preferred a gradual approach to both to downsizing and to a rounding and a smoothing and a lowering that you're gradually coming to in the next 5 years. Was that a reflection of your personality, your philosophy, design philosophy?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think the corporate approach to downsizing vehicles was a matter of cost and resources.
Mm-hmm.
We could not have taken all of GM's products in, say, a 3 or 4 or 5 year span and downsized them.
Mm-hmm.
Even General Motors couldn't do that.
I see. Okay.
There's a lot of money involved in doing a new car program today.
So it had to be a gradual...
It had to be spread out over time, selecting the vehicles to downsize that would move us toward those cafe figures.
Right.
We were aiming at those numbers. I don't remember them exactly how they went, but I think they started somewhere around 18 miles to the gallon corporate fuel economy average and went to 20 and then 22 and 24, whatever it was, and it's 27 and a half next year.
Yeah.
So the products were selected that would keep us on top of that or ahead of those fuel numbers,
mm-hmm.
average fuel numbers. And even if that wasn't a target, the corporation could not have done all of their vehicles in 5 years. We didn't have the resources here to do it, and I don't imagine General Motors had the financial resources to do it in that time frame. Mm-hmm. So we had to take a program at a time and be sure that we had done it right.
Mm-hmm. So it was financial constraints, obviously.
Played a large part in this.
But even so, there has been, I think, if I'm reading recent history correct, your approach to design has, if indeed it is your approach, dictated perhaps by that financial constraint to downsizing, but your approach has been one of a gradual movement toward the future rather than jumping maybe 5 years ahead.
Are you talking about the vehicles that have been accomplished while I've been in this office?
Well, the last 10 years, say.
How do I answer that? I don't know that you could say it's a gradual, measured approach. Mm-hmm. We try to reach out as far as we can with each program we do, but one of the key factors in any design program here at design staff, General Motors design staff, is to maintain the personality of that divisional car.
Right.
We will not, as an example, do what our friends at Ford did.
Right.
They had some very stiff, harsh automobiles, and in a year's time, they turn right around and do soft, rounded cars, and the former T-Bird doesn't look like a present T-Bird. Well, that can have a hell of an impact on the resale value of the old car, and we're trying to protect our customers who are out there with a vehicle that's a year old or 2 years old, that resale values remain strong. And if I'm the customer and I'm driving today, I say in those 70s, I was driving a 72 or 73 Cadillac, and we downsized it in 77. It was smaller, but it was still a Cadillac. It had all the cues up front and in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to move away from that. The personality of the vehicle is there, and we're going to move that personality forward as far as we can.
Well, I think this is an admirable approach, especially for General Motors, with your large number of car lines, the shock would have been too much for the average GM buyer to jump 5 years
mm-hmm.
ahead, that you preferred to retain the identity, protect the previous buyers, and to hope to court new buyers.
Yeah, I think you look at what we did with the third generation Firebird and Camaro. They're strongly related to the second generation car, but they're new and they're fresh and they're faster looking, smoother. And I think you could say that about a Corvette. You don't need labels on the new Corvette. You know it's a Corvette. However, on the other hand, if we get an entirely new program and there wasn't anything before this car we're now doing, such as the Fiero, then we try to create the personality that we can carry down the road for many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on that car for something like 2 years, maybe a year and a half downstairs in our advanced rooms and another 6 to 7 months in the Pontiac studio refining it. But everything I read indicates that people who like to play sports machines think this is one fine looking car.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere you look, you see young ladies driving them.
Oh,
they
yes.
love them too. So I have to believe that this team did a good job with something new. Now we've got a personality to work with, and you won't see the next generation of Fieros turn around and head 180 degrees in the other direction. That's just not going to happen here.
But, as you point out, the Fiero was a jump ahead. That was really taking off. And as I think you indicated earlier, that was a special design project. Was it not?
That's right.
It was off to one side from your bread and butter.
It was completely off to one side, buried in our advanced room, with Pontiac having a strong interest in it and very concerned about whether they could sell a two-place car to the corporation, because you have to ask yourself how many two-place cars does General Motors need.
Right.
On the other hand, the market in North America today is very diversified. The standard sedan, coupe, and wagon is no longer going to entertain that entire group of consumers out there. So you've got to have a wide variety of products. I don't think if you look back in the late 60s and early 70s, a car like an Impala and Caprice, you could sell 1.5 million of those in 1 year. I don't think we look for volumes such as that anymore. If you can do 600,000 or 700,000 of one body type, you've done a hell of a job today. And in some cases, and you're going to see more two-place automobiles from General Motors. Buick is going to introduce a two-place car. Mm-hmm. Cadillac will very shortly. Mm-hmm. And what's up the road remains to be seen, but the customer is dictating where we must go. Yeah. We're not doing
it. I don't want to move you too far ahead, but I'm fascinated by the reports about the Pininfarina Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
Is that set as of mid-1985? Are you going to go ahead with that?
Yeah, they designed the car, and they're building the body, and the body will be air-shipped to our new plant in Detroit Hamtramck, and the running gear will be put into that car in that mm-hmm. plant. And that was the process decided on by corporate management. I must say, in all honesty, it didn't please us here at design staff.
No, why was that?
That Pininfarina got the design assignment.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And
how'd that come about? Remember offhand?
Well, no, I can't remember exactly how that happened, but I know that Cadillac wanted to do a two-place car, and we were preparing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got word, I believe, from my boss, Howard Carroll, who's the vice chairman of General Motors, that they were going to ask Pininfarina to design the car. And that didn't make me happy, and it didn't make any of the management team happy here, and the Cadillac studio was all upset. Mm-hmm. Chief designer Wayne Cady was walking around with a frown, and I mm-hmm. thought, win, lose, or draw, I've got to give these fellas a shot at the program,
uh-huh.
even though the decision might have been made that Pininfarina is going to do it. Well, we got started, but we didn't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
Pininfarina had been working on it for some months. And when I made the decision, he was probably 5 or 6 months into the program, and he was to bring a car here in about 60 to 90 days,
mm-hmm.
so into our auditorium. So we hurried a two-place car, and I informed management that I was doing it. And they weren't too sure it was the right thing to do, but I explained the problems I was having with
sure.
the team, and I think they ought to have a shot at it.
Right.
Well, I can recall, and I'll try not to use names here, walking out to the auditorium, and the Pininfarina car was sitting there, and our clay model was sitting there. And I was walking toward the auditorium with certain members of the executive team downtown when they informed me, Irv, regardless of how much better your car may look than the one Sergio is doing, we're going to select his, because we believe if it's his design, he'll do a better job of engineering and fabrication and build the quality into it that's necessary. And that's how the decision was made.
It obviously still rankles.
Pardon me?
It obviously still rankles.
It did for a while, but we're over that.
Oh, you're
we're over that, because we've got a lot of programs coming through this building, and once a decision is made, I set that behind me, and we go on and do the other work.
Good.
And then, of course, Lloyd Royce was running Buick at the time, and it was really Buick that started the idea of a two-place car. They came to us first.
When was that?
My, I can't remember in what time frame that happened. I probably was in this office for about 2 years when that happened. And Lloyd came to me, and he said he'd like to do a two-place Buick. And we got started on a few proposals, and then for a variety of reasons, none of which I can remember at this time, Buick backed away a little.
Oh.
But Cadillac got wind of the idea that Buick was working on this, so they jumped in quickly. And they did this thing with Pininfarina and the corporation. But when the decision was made to have Pininfarina do the car, design it, and build it, the body, it was right after that the Buick group, and I think it was still Lloyd. Yes, it was still Lloyd. Came back and said, I want to get started on this. I don't know how much of a chance I've got to sell it, but I want to do this. Get me a hot car.
Mm-hmm.
So having lost the Cadillac project, our team was all fired up. And we spent about a year putting this Buick together. And I can recall the Buick being shown to the corporation prior to a product policy group where the program was going to be presented. And I took our chairman out there and our president, and we had the car in the hallway on the second floor, and I showed him the Buick, and Roger walked around it and said, my God, that's one hell of a good-looking car. Now, I don't know how they're reacting about the appearance of the Buick relative to the Cadillac, but I know they like the look of the Buick, and that satisfies us.
Since you know we'll be listening to this for another 2 or 3 years, can you tell me your personal opinion as to the relative qualities of the two?
Appearance-wise?
Yeah.
Well, Dave, that's...
Is that a leading question?
That's not a leading question. It's just that having been so deeply involved in the two-place Buick, it's very difficult, I suspect, to be objective about this.
Well, we don't want you to be objective. We want you to be subjective.
You know, it's... well, that way, I believe we've got a hell of a finer looking car than the Cadillac, of course. And if I didn't feel that way, I shouldn't be here.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, good. These will be out in, 88,
87? I think, if I remember the dates, will you, Dave?
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. About the differences in style and approach that between you and Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Earle, especially Mr. Earle, whose large size and would intimidate people, along with his rather forceful personality, in terms of getting executives to accept design changes and so forth. And, mm-hmm. You indicated that you had a different approach.
I have a different approach, Dave, of course, and I think I'm operating in a time frame that's entirely different than... Are we running?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Entirely different than the time frame Earl operated in.
Right.
If you go back to the 20s, 30s, and the 40s, and the 50s, a boss was a boss, whether his name was Harley Earl, or Mr. X, or Mr. Y, or Mr. Z. He was the boss. Yeah. But our society has changed fantastically over the last 30, 40 years. And that approach couldn't be used today. It would be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to focus on people. You've got to help them grow.
Mm-hmm.
You do not intimidate them. I'm not sure that, and I've heard this over the years, I'm not sure that Harley Earl went out of his way to intimidate people on his staff. I did gain the impression, and I had worked for Mr. Earl about 11 or 12 years, that he went after those that he considered weak, spineless. Because I had a lot to do with Earl when I ran the Oldsmobile studio, and I dealt with him on a daily basis, and he was always very nice to me and always very kind. And if I had something he didn't like, he would point it out, that he didn't think it was any good, that he never really got angry with me. And if he did, it wouldn't have frightened me, because I fear no man, regardless of title.
Right. Mm-hmm. Good. One of the things that occurred to me in our discussions a few minutes ago was lots of things occurred to me, but two things I think we should look into momentarily was the sports car syndrome that General Motors fostered, I think, pretty much, starting with the Corvette,
mm-hmm.
and you were the leader there, and coming up to your magnificent Z28, is it?
Camaro, Firebird, and the Z28.
Right, yeah.
But the Camaro and Firebird were the result of the Mustang.
Oh. See, that's right. You
Mustang announced their car somewhere in April in the New York World's Fair, but what the consumer doesn't know,
mm-hmm.
and probably the people at Ford, Mr. Knutson, Bunky Knutson, was running Chevrolet at the time,
mm-hmm.
and Chevrolet had added quite a few cars over the years because mm-hmm. the market was demanding it, and Buick had the Riviera. And Buick and Bill sold that on his own to the Buick division.
Bill
he
Mitchell.
Was yes, he was very strong for getting a personalized coupe, and Buick bought it. And we looked at the volumes that Buick was turning the first year, and I was running Chevrolet Studio at the time, and
mm-hmm.
I sat down with the team. We had a little discussion about if Buick can sell X number of cars in one year at that price, what if we did a little personalized car?
Mm-hmm.
How many would Chevrolet sell if the price were right? And of course, we wouldn't go the Buick route because that's a more formal, sophisticated four-place automobile. We'd do something to appeal to the youth of America,
mm-hmm.
something sporty and dynamic.
Right.
Well, we talked ourselves into it. And I came to Bill and I chatted with him about it. And he said, well, all right, if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. You got room? And we didn't have room in the studio, so we have a warehouse across 12 Mile Road.
Uh-huh.
And we went over there and worked on this car. I had a fellow working on it who is now in charge of Advance One. His name is Phil Garcia. And we put together some ideas and found one we liked and modeled the automobile. And having the operation away from this building, Bill didn't get involved.
Mm-hmm.
So we had pretty free hand.
Yeah.
created the car in clay, dynocked it, and I invited Bill over, and he took one walk around it, and he says, gee, that's a damn good-looking car. We better get Bunky over here. So we got Newson over about a week later. Bunky walked around the car and says, damned exciting. But he says, I want to tell you something, fellas. The last thing Chevrolet needs is another car. And that ended that four-place, what would have been the Camaro program. And that was about, I'm guessing now, maybe 7 or 8 months before, maybe a year before Ford announced the Mustang the following year in April. It was there for everyone to see that there was a need in that spot at the low end of the market. And of course, Ford brought the Mustang out, and General Motors didn't react to it until the first year numbers came in, and I think they sold something over 400,000. And then we started moving fast. The question of whether Chevrolet needed another car or not was
a moot point.
Yeah, it was a moot point at that time. And we went right after the Camaro.
Had you kept the project sort of...
No, it wasn't kept alive. No, the armature was used for another program. Oh. We photographed the car. Mm-hmm. And when we got the word we'd better get started on a four-place sporty vehicle, it wasn't called Camaro at the time.
Right.
It had an XP number. We thought we'd go back to that. But the decision was made that it would have to come off the Chevy 2 underbody and cowl and use the suspension and engines and so forth and windshield, and we didn't have the flexibility. We couldn't reach the car we were doing at the warehouse. So the original Camaro, while it did well in the market, was not satisfying for anyone here in this building. Not Jack, not myself, not the chief designers involved. Henry Haga was the chief designer of that studio at the time. He's now out on the West Coast running our Advanced Concept Center.
H-A-G-A?
H-A-G-A? Yes. Mm-hmm. And we did what we were asked to do, but when that program was finished, I got with our vehicle packaging group and we started planning the second generation car.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no interference, so we did a new underbody and placed the seats where we wanted it and got the cross section. And about a year or so later, we started modeling it. And when we started, Bill Porter was in charge of Pontiac. He was going to do the Firebird Trans Am, and Hank Haga was going to do the Camaro Z28.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little contest going between the two groups, Pontiac and Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
We selected the upper that Bill Porter's team did, windshield,
mm-hmm.
upper profile line, side glass, graphics,
mm-hmm.
and put that on the Camaro. And got precisely what we wanted. The divisions weren't involved. They were busy selling cars. They had to sell cars. They had to engineer.
Right.
And we took some time with that program, and Bill was delighted with every step as we went.
Yes, I can imagine.
Yep. And when we invited the general managers in, and I don't remember who they were, there was no question about the vehicles. No question at
all. Instant acceptance.
Yep. The Pontiac group liked what they had, and the Chevrolet, don't touch it, leave it alone, release it, and that's the way we go.
Good.
And the car, I believe the car made its mark. It was out in the market for 10 or 11 years,
mm-hmm.
with just facial changes,
right,
and graphics,
yeah.
in the rear.
It's been a real success story.
It lived a long time. It was a very profitable program for General Motors.
Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been too much change. I think you did introduce the Berlinetta, which didn't go over so well. But
Well, the Berlinetta, when we did the second generation Camaro Firebird, we did a base car and a performance car.
Oh, okay.
And it came through to us that there were a lot of young ladies driving the car, and maybe we should tailor an automobile,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in between base and performance that women would like. And that's why we did cars like the Berlinetta. And Pontiac had one in the middle there, too. I don't recall now what they called it, but they've given up on that one.
Yeah. It was a good idea, but apparently the ladies wanted the hot car.
The ladies seemed to buy what men like.
Right.
They like the same cars.
Yeah.
And the industry for years has been talking about, let's tailor this type of car for women.
Mm-hmm.
It has always failed. Women like the same automobiles men do.
Of course they do, yeah. They're competing with them now, in the marketplace.
They are just like men when it comes to wheels. There are girls that like to go fast. I have a daughter that wouldn't buy anything but a performance automobile.
Isn't that marvelous?
How old is she? Then you'll, pardon me?
How old is she?
She's 29.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's my daughter.
Living
in
Boston.
Right.
And you couldn't sell her a four banger under any circumstances. She's got to have a quick automobile. And then there are ladies, just like there are men, who want fuel efficiency and a lot of room. And,
yeah.
They're no different.
No, it's a different market. There's no longer a differentiation, at least a one that you can say that exists. They're fluid now.
Well, we did some colors on both the Firebird and Camaro about halfway through the second generation car that were supposed to be tailored for the female. They were bright and and cute and so forth. Why, the colors didn't do a thing out there. Women didn't buy them at all.
What are your plans for the sports car? Practically a division now, isn't it? A subdivision, really. Have you got some interesting innovations in the next 5 to 10 years as far as sports cars? Or are you going to pretty much gradually bring it along?
Well, no, we're not going to gradually bring it along. We are doing and almost have completed the next generation of Camaro Firebird. We've got a fiberglass model out there that's set the mood for this car. As a matter of fact, Dave, much like the second generation car, this fourth generation car that'll be introduced in the fall of 89 was done about the time we had just released the car that's out on the street. And the assistant chief designer in Chevrolet 3, off on his own, just created a full-size rendering. And I walked in the room one day, damn, that's a dynamic looking thing. So I went to the chief designer, and it's Jerry Palmer. And I said, Jerry, have you got any resources to model that? He says, I'll find them. So within 4 to 6 months, we had the vehicle outdoors several times, and we refined it, and I liked what I saw in clay, so I elected to use some financial resources to build a fiberglass model. I wanted that around to live with it, to see how well it lives. And we had it around this building for probably 2 years before the bell rang to start the 89-90 program. And it lived well. Everyone who came in here and the corporate management said, gee, that's a dynamic car. And that set the mood for what we're doing in 89.
That's great.
And we're taking a step with this car that goes beyond anything we've done with past Camaro and Firebirds.
Good.
However, you will know it is a Camaro.
You still maintain the identity.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
It has many innovative features. Its performance will be equal to or better than. It's rumored in the newspapers it may be front-wheel drive. I'm not at liberty to say what wheels will drive the car. But let me tell you, it will be an interesting package, and I think our Camaro Firebird customers and followers out there are going to enjoy this one.
Oh, marvelous. That sounds great. Along the other end of it, the Corvette. Now, the new Corvette in 85 is a real smashing success story. Plus, plus the design is quite striking. I'm quite taken with the new generation Corvette. It seems to me that that while some of the purists, I know you've had to contend with these Corvette purists all these years.
You're out there.
Will say that you've bastardized it. You've succumbed to the recent design mania for a Euro look or whatever. But I think, can you tell me what kind of a considered decision that was in your area, how that came about?
Sure. The purist, perhaps, and a lot of other people who are not necessarily purists, including Bill Mitchell, who has told me that you messed up the Corvette. But the Corvette before this one, in our view, was right in that time frame, but overstated for the 80s. Simply because a Corvette, like any other car, has to have sound aerodynamic numbers. And you could not have jumped the fenders up off the body as high as the Corvette preceding this one. And as we did aero studies, we tried as hard as we knew how within the aerodynamic framework to keep that subtle bounce in the silhouette of the car. We got as much as we could without upsetting the aerodynamic numbers. Now the Corvette, you might say, well, aero-wise, its coefficient of drag isn't quite as good as I'd expect because it's at 0.35, and there are a lot of cars out there at 0.35. But what pushed the number up that high is the footprint. We've got some very wide tires on that car for ride, handling, and so forth. And if you take and put a standard set of rubber under that vehicle, the coefficient of drag drops under 3 into the 2 range. So it's just a wide footprint that pushed us up to 3.5. But these are the trade-offs you have to make between aero and ride, handling, performance, and so on. So aerodynamics was an important factor in the design of that vehicle. I personally believe the car is correct for this time frame.
Gorgeous. What I seem to recall reading somewhere, hearing somewhere, that the designer on that project was a local product out of Homer Lagasse's shop.
Yeah, the Center for Creative Studies, Jerry Palmer.
Jerry Palmer.
Jerry Palmer was involved in the, he was chief designer and involved in the current Camaro and Z28. Mm-hmm. And Jerry's team put the Corvette together.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see a coupe that'll be introduced in the fall of 86. That's a part of two sedans,
mm-hmm,
that was done by Jerry's group. It's called the Beretta.
Oh, yes.
And Jerry's team did that.
Mm-hmm.
They're a very aggressive, far-out group. They do some damned interesting cars.
Must be fun working with a group like that.
Oh, huh? Yes. Jerry is a good designer, very good designer.
That's great.
And totally involved with automobiles.
The other what sticks in my mind, which may not be important, but I'd love to hear your version of it. The Seville, the original Seville, was a personal and sales success, and then somebody decided to give it a new look. How did that come about?
You're talking about the second generation,
right?
Seville?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting story, Dave, because when we knew we had to start the second generation car, I was working on that with Jack Humbert and Wayne Cady, who's the chief designer at Cadillac, and what we had started was taking that original and projecting it out a step or two or three farther.
Mm-hmm.
And we were into the program for about 2 or 3 months, and Bill came in one day and he said, "Now, fellas, that's not it. You haven't got it. Now, I'll tell you what I have in mind." And he made a little sketch, and it was very much like a Rolls of the 30s with his
his old obsession
profile in the rear, and we didn't think too much of that, the design team, but he insisted.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You're going to do that damn car that way, and don't give me a bad timer if that's how I want it." So we got up on the boards and taped it and retaped it and rendered it and wiggled it and tickled it and refined it, and then we thought, well, I guess we're pretty close, let's model it.
Mm-hmm.
We got in the clay, and Bill was delighted with the results all the way through, but there were many of us who felt that the rear profile wasn't working well with the face of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But the face of the vehicle had to be a Cadillac, you know. You couldn't drop the nose down as you're doing today in that time frame. So we went with it. You know, I think we had a little trouble in the first year or two convincing the customer that that was the right statement, but in recent years it seems to have caught on, and the volumes are increasing.
The instinct was correct, I think,
mm-hmm,
even though you have had some detractors.
Yeah, and in spite of where the volumes have gone in recent years, I would not have moved in that direction personally.
Yeah.
But he was the boss,
mm-hmm,
and the car we were doing, I thought, was pretty dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Still got a sketch of it around somewhere?
Oh, we have photographs of the clay model.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Love to see it sometime.
It was a car I really liked. I really enjoyed it, but, you know, being number two or three or whatever I was at the time, that didn't give me the opportunity to push that one through.
Well, Bill has retired.
Oh, yes.
Point, and he probably retired somewhat reluctantly, don't you think?
I don't know. I suspect it's hard to say. When a man has been in the business for 40 some odd years,
yeah,
he may be ready for another challenge.
Yeah.
And Bill never did open up to me, and I don't believe anyone else around here, as to how he felt about walking out the door in the latter part of July in 77. He never admitted to me that it was a hard thing to do.
Yeah, I guess he wouldn't. It just
probably
against his
not.
Nature.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, he told me that that Harley Earl called him in his office and says, "You're going to succeed me."
Mm-hmm.
Said, and then he tells a hilarious story about Jack Gordon calling him in and saying, "I don't like a goddamn bit what you're doing."
Well,
I mean, what Earl is doing.
Yeah, you know. I think they sat right in that couch when Jack Gordon
really
told him that I'm not on your team, I want you to know that.
That's right.
I think those are the words Bill used on me.
Well, that's what I want to know. What did Bill say to you when he
He just told me that the president of General Motors at the time flat out stated that he wasn't on Bill's team. I would not have voted for you to run this place. Well, that's... that's getting off to a pretty hectic start, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The president isn't on your team. Now,
this is old Jack
this
Gordon,
is, but, yeah, this is what Bill told me. I wasn't there. Yeah, I didn't hear it. Yeah. It's hearsay as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what I'm getting at is, what did Bill then tell you when he was retiring?
What did Bill then
tell you when he was retiring? Did he call you in and say, Irv, it looks like I'm leaving in 6 months, and we've got to work out a succession. And how did that come
about? He didn't. No, we never had any of conversation. I'm not even sure that had Bill been the final choice, that I would have been his man. I don't. Mm-hmm. I personally don't think so.
Uh-huh.
He would have focused on someone else in the organization. I believe the decision to move me into this job was made downtown.
Ah, okay.
But I can tell you this. I probably was in this office 2 days when Pete Estes walked in and he said, well, are you settled, kid? I said, yes, I'm all moved in and ready to go. He said, now, I want you to know, Irv, if there's anything you need, if you need any help from me, you just call me anytime you want.
That's marvelous.
Now, if Bill's story is true about Gordon, I got off to a beautiful start with Pete Estes and Tom Murphy and so forth.
Will you indulge me a bit to correct or to affirm a story I've heard from somewhere, is that with Harley Earl and Bill Mitchell, what 40 years of 40 or 50 years of conflict and adversarial situations with top management, do you think that Estes and the rest thought that Irv will move into a different sphere. He'll handle things differently.
I don't know. I really don't know, Dave. Perhaps thoughts like that crossed the table at the boardroom when they were trying to make this decision.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
No one downtown has ever said to me, we have put you in this assignment for these reasons.
Okay. Yeah.
I suspect we are very visible here where the corporation management is concerned. They spend a lot of time on design staff, and they know us very well.
Yeah.
And they probably made the decision based on what they had observed here in the building. And I did operate differently than some of the other executives in the building. I never used a baseball bat on anyone who reported to Irv, and I don't today.
Well, I suspect that story is true. I think that they found in you a person who would work well with the staff, would not have to, as you say, use a baseball bat.
I'm quite a bit different than the other two people as I see it. In this way, Dave, how do I say it without sounding like I'm patting myself on the back? I don't mean to say it that way.
Yeah, right.
But I'm totally involved in every facet of this operation, not just the design studios. I deal directly with the comptroller and all the budget problems we may have and how we spend the money. Because whether I'm spending General Motors money or my own, I want a dollar's worth of value for every buck I spend here.
Sure.
I'm not going to throw a penny down the sewer. And I get involved in labor relations problems and personnel problems and just about every facet of this business. I wouldn't feel comfortable in this office if I didn't know what was going on totally within design staff.
Well, that's something of a new breed of design.
I don't think it was done in the past. We always had an administrative assistant.
Right.
Earl had one, and Mitchell had one,
and
they ran the business end of design staff and concerned themselves totally with the studios.
Right. Yeah.
My approach to let the people run in the studios perhaps buys some time to do these other things.
Yeah.
But I couldn't sit in this office and rely on someone else to handle the budget and where the dollars are spent. I've got to know those things.
That's great, yeah. Well, I think probably this has contributed to your success in the last 10 years.
Perhaps it has.
Yeah, that you are totally involved, totally engaged, and let your people select the people you want to run the divisions and this divisional studios.
I'll say this, Dave, we've hit the budget right on the head every year since I've been in this office.
That's incredible.
That takes attention and
it
control.
It sure does, attention to detail. Yeah.
And control.
And control. And commitment. Yeah.
And commitment, absolutely.
The new situation, you're moving into the electronic and space eras very rapidly at General Motors. Here is mid-85. How do you see your role as the design role in these situations today with the new
You're talking about EDS and Hughes?
Hughes, EDS, the Saturn Project, the whole mix of electronic
systems.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How does the design center fit with that matrix?
I suspect, and remember, we're new at it with EDS.
Right. And there have been some problems.
There have been minor problems, nothing serious in my view, but I suspect over the long term we will gain a lot working with EDS and their knowledge of computer systems, because in this building, I'm not a computer expert, but I'd always asked a lot of questions about buying a new piece of equipment. Well, this piece of equipment talked to that piece of equipment downstairs, and we were sort of buying it from the hip. And I just had a meeting yesterday with the EDS team that services the tech center, and they were laying out their plans and what finally is going to happen here at Design Staff. And I'm confident within the next 5 years, efficiency will increase tenfold in this building. These people know what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Now, how we're going to relate, and we don't have computer experts of that nature in this building.
Right.
We have people who are designing new systems for us within
mm-hmm.
the building.
Yeah.
But not systems people, per se.
Yeah.
Now, how we relate to Hughes, I have no idea at this time. I think everyone in the corporation is feeling their way, and the relationship will probably be stronger between advanced engineering, Bob Eaton's staff, or research staff, Bob Frosch's group, with Hughes, mm-hmm. than with design staff. Now, we had a luncheon here the other day when the Hughes team came out to visit General Motors and Tech Center, and the luncheon was held in our dining room, and we had the chairman and the president of Hughes here, and I got to chatting with Mr. Puckett, who is the chairman. He was sitting at my table. I was hosting this luncheon.
Mm-hmm.
And I reminded him that we were bargaining for a piece of land in California that overlooks the Pacific, and when I turn my back on the ocean, I'm looking right up at the Hughes Research Center. And I said, you know, it might be interesting in the future if
sure.
we get the building in there to do some business together. And
mm-hmm.
he said, yes, it might be. So,
have you since finalized that?
No, nothing has been done along those lines, because I don't believe the final purchase of Hughes is yet complete.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
We haven't issued any stock, so
yeah.
I would imagine it's not completed as yet. I'm not that close to that
right.
end of the
yeah. But Saturn appears to be in your orbit.
Well, Saturn's been with us for several years.
Yeah. How, mm-hmm. Without revealing any trade secrets, can you give us a sort of a rundown on how Saturn evolved, how it began, and how it evolved, and how you sold management on it?
Well, we did an S-car mm-hmm. some maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago that was supposed to replace our Chevette.
Mm-hmm.
It was a front-wheel drive car, it was three-door, and the program was completed, and it was a handsome little vehicle, I might mm-hmm. say that. We've got photos of it here.
Uh-huh.
And when the engineering and the cost people got into it, General Motors discovered they were way over the mark relative to Japanese cost-wise.
Right.
I think we were something like $1,800 to $2,000 more expensive than any Japanese car of the same weight and same carrying capacity, same wheelbase, power, and so forth. So the program was stopped. And I believe that's how this new approach evolved. I wasn't a part of the planning process downtown, but apparently the decision was made to start with a clean sheet of paper, form a new corporation, and attack the processes to take the cost out. You couldn't build this little car as we have been building cars for the last 70-some-odd years. That started a team here at the tech center that was called the Saturn Task Force, reporting to Alex Mayer, who's a group executive out here.
M-A-Y-E-R?
Pardon me?
M-A-Y-E-R?
M-A-I-R.
M-A-I-R.
Mm-hmm. Alex Mayer. And it was largely a tech center team put together, and they had manufacturing people and engineering people and all the skills and the cost people, and when they had done enough spade work, they came to us and said, now, we'd like a body for this program we're working on. And we started working closely with them to understand their goals, where the costs might be, how we might have to go about designing this car. And we were putting one together. Well, we put one together quickly. And they took our surfaces, and they were going to build the first prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fiberglass model.
Mm-hmm.
And then
go ahead.
Roger Smith decided, our chairman, that he was going to show this, announce this Saturn project to the press, show the car. And we did that, I believe, in January, 2 years back, or maybe earlier in the year. I can't recall exactly when. This past January is when he announced the Saturn Corporation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Prior to that, he announced the Saturn project.
Right.
And he made the decision that he was going to show that fiberglass model to the press.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, we weren't all that happy with that first effort, because it went quickly. And when the car was on stage and the press were there and Roger gave a speech about the Saturn project, when he finished and the press were milling around photographing it and doing all these things, I went over to the chairman and I said, you know, now that, because it was opening the door for me, I said, now that you've shown this to the press, we're not going to let our competitors see what we're going to do in the late 80s, so I'm going back to work and I'm going to do another car. You are? I said, yes, I am. He said, fine, do it. So we started what we call the second generation Saturn. And we finished that about, I'd say a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But as time wears on and we do other programs, Saturn can age right here in this building.
Mm-hmm.
So within the last few months, these cars that we thought were very exciting
uh-huh.
are being changed, even now as I talk.
Mm-hmm. Stuff up there because I don't want to lose them.